We now move on to a session I mentioned earlier, which is a slight change from the originally published timetable. A focus on risk and crisis management. We're very pleased to have with us Stephen O'Doherty from Scotland Yard. Stephen joined Scotland Yard Solicitors Department in 1974 and has prosecuted ever since. He's currently the Deputy Director of the Crime Prosecution Service and is the CPS lead on homicide. He's written the training package on this for the service. He has helped draft the Corporate Manslaughter Act 2007, which is his subject for us this afternoon, and has written the CPS guidance on that subject. He's the only trainer in the CPOS on that particular subject. I fear this is going to be one of those sessions which we wish could have gone on for longer, but we're asking Stephen to talk for about 20 minutes, and then we will have 5 minutes for questions. So we're looking forward to some insightful questions on the topic of corporate manslaughter. May we welcome Stephen to the floor.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for the opportunity to speak to you today. Can I just start by saying it's quite daunting being up here. You're a very bright, alert, intelligent audience, and I'm more used to dealing with lawyers. So I trust you'll bear with me this afternoon. Those of you who've looked at the short biography will have seen in there that I was the lawyer who took the decision to prosecute the police for the tragic death of John Charles de Menezes back in 2005, an incident that took place at Stockwell Underground Station. I imagine most of you will be aware of that particular incident. Now, I'm not going to talk about that today. What I would say is this. If an organisation as professional as the Metropolitan Police, with the resources at their disposal, an organisation which is dedicated to the protection of the public, can make such a tragic mistake in the attitude towards work-related deaths. Many years ago, they were just viewed as being workplace accidents. There may be compensation provided to the families, but very rarely, if ever, was there a prosecution. And then, starting probably in about 1966, were the first hints of a change. Now, I'm going to deal later on with the Health and Safety at Work Act. But what I'm going to do this afternoon is I'm going to deal with three particular areas. I'm going to deal with Corporate Manslaughter Act, which came in April 2008. I'm going to deal with the Health and Safety at Work Act, and also what I'd like to do is just to highlight for you as individuals your own possible personal potential for criminal proceedings. Probably with the Corporate Manslaughter Act, it probably started with the Herald of Free Enterprise that went down. I think most people remember that, would wonder how you can set sail with the bow doors open. Well, you may not be aware of it, but it wasn't the first time, and they got away with it. But of course, in this particular instance, they didn't. The ship went down with 197 people killed. Following year, we had the Piper Alpha disaster off the North Sea, 167 people killed. And as a result of these, there was a groundswell of opinion saying, this can't be tolerated anymore. These are corporate manslaughters. The companies are being run in a reckless fashion. There should be a criminal offence. Those campaigns have ultimately led to the Corporate Manslaughter Act. I imagine that most people will have heard of the Corporate Manslaughter Act. I certainly hope they have, but they won't know how it operates. What about the Health and Safety at Work Act? people know how that operates. What about the implications for your organisation? We heard a few moments ago from Bob about the difficulties that you will face with the finances. One thing I would say at this stage is if you cut back on your health and safety procedures and you end up in court, you will pay far higher price than you will ever save in cutting your costs. So why did the Corporate Manslaughter Act come in? There were a number of disasters we couldn't prosecute. In brief, what we had in order to prosecute a company was the ability to prosecute in some of the train cases. In others, we decided we just could not prosecute because of this problem of the controlling mind theory. So cases such as the crashes at Ladbroke Grove, Potter's Bar, Hatfield, ended up with no prosecution for corporate manslaughter or failed prosecutions. The reality was that these companies were getting away with manslaughter. They were prosecuted for health and safety, but not for manslaughter. And that led to a 10-year campaign to try and bring in a Corporate Manslaughter Act. The other difficulty was that you couldn't aggregate negligence from different people. You had to have this individual. So the problem was if Director A did something and Director B did something else, both of which were negligent, we couldn't prosecute for manslaughter unless we could prosecute one of those individuals. So eventually we get to the Corporate Manslaughter Act. As I say, it was about a decade, the longest act I think I've ever known taken to get onto the statute book. It changed so many times during the course of its passage through various papers, until eventually we get to the situation, the act comes in and actually is effected from April of 2008. And somebody's going to say to me, well, how many prosecutions have there been? I'll come back to that particular issue a bit later on if you'll bear with me. So how does the Corporate Manslaughter Act work? It now does look at the systems. And the way it operates, it looks at breaches of health and safety. You can be prosecuted for corporate manslaughter where someone is killed and the conduct of the organisation in the way the senior management have organised the company's activities falls far below what could reasonably be expected. A couple of phrases in there. But one of the things I would say is that if you were to go back, as I have tried to do, and look at those failed cases, looking at it with a new test, I think the outcomes could well have been different. I think in some of those instances, we would be prosecuting. I suspect that the outcomes would also have been different. And I'll deal with the question of penalties later on, because that will be very much in your minds as to when you balance the risk of being prosecuted with the likely fine that would be imposed. Well, what about the senior management? Who are they? Looking around here, I have absolutely no doubt that as far as your organisation, it's quite a wide remit in it. The police virtually are not covered. They did some superb lobbying, I have to say. But they're pretty much exempt. But almost everybody else is included, and that means also the Crown Prosecution Service. Now that's going to be really interesting if I have to advise prosecuting the director. He's not going to be too happy with me, and I don't know who would actually conduct the prosecution. But as far as we're concerned here today, all of your organisations are covered by the Act. Let me now turn to the Health and Safety at Work Act. This is an act that's been in since 1974. It arose from the Abervan disaster back in 1966. I see some people here almost as old as me, and they'll probably remember it. And what's perhaps quite ironic is that the head of the coal board at the time, Lord Robins, actually came up with the plan for the Health and Safety at Work Act. And this is a very wide-ranging act. It's almost the baby brother of the Corporate Manslaughter Act. The two are intended to work in tandem. So you start off at the health and safety, and then if you've got that, you can move on to the corporate manslaughter act. But the Health and Safety Act is important in its own right. And I'm not going to discuss things like, you may have seen in the paper just the other day, a company that said you've got to walk up the stairs and hold onto the handrail. You've got to reverse your car into the car park. I'm not going to deal with those sort of things. But under the Health and Safety at Work Act, you will have responsibilities to your employees and, in effect, anybody affected by what your company does. And you will be guilty of an offence. You don't even need somebody to be injured or killed. You can be guilty of the offence where you leave a risk of injury or death, and it was reasonably practicable to have avoided it. Now, I don't just say reasonable, it's reasonably practicable. So if something could have been done and wasn't, then the offence is committed. And it's a lovely little catch-22. I was talking to a colleague at the Health and Safety Executive, and he said, well, what we do, if we start a prosecution and the company puts it right, we say, you see, it was reasonably practicable all along. And if they don't put it right, we say, look at this company, just how lax are they? They really don't care about health and safety. So catch 20, we look at what the reasonable person would have thought. And we do prosecute and we get convictions for individuals who say, well, I just didn't realise, I didn't see there was a danger. Nope, well, you should have done. As a senior manager, you're also liable to be prosecuted under the Health and Safety at Work Act if you have condoned the company's breach of that act. At the moment, the Health and Safety Executive have tended not to prosecute individuals. That is changing. Okay, what about the penalties involved? This is usually where people become interested or saddened, depending on which state of mind they have. What's the penalty if your organisation is convicted under either the Corporate Manslaughter Act or Health and Safety at Work Act? Well, there's some slight relief, but it is very slight. The penalties for a breach that led to a death, the average is around about £30,000. Average means, obviously, some are high, some are low. Proposals that were being come out last year were changed, and I can tell you that my understanding now is that the current guidance that's going to come out fairly soon on this is that the Sentencing Guidelines Council will recommend that a breach of the Health and Safety at Work Act, which leads to a death, will result in a fine which will seldom be less than £100,000. So the average at the moment is 30. It may be hundreds of thousands of pounds. If your organisation is convicted of corporate manslaughter, the fine will be significantly higher. It will seldom be less than £500,000 and may run into the multiple millions. To give you an idea of how the culture has changed in the courts on sentencing, in 1997, Great Western Trains were fined £1.5 million following the Southall train crash. In that accident, seven people died. In 2005, Transco was fined £15 million, where four people had died. The attitude of the courts has been to increase the fines quite severely. The Sentencing Guidelines Council is talking about increasing it even more. But in some ways, that may not be the word just waiting to pick up your business if you're convicted of this offence. On the personal side, a person convicted of gross negligence manslaughter or even a breach of the health and safety laws which results in death faces a term of imprisonment. Now, it's not all bad news. Fines could have been worse. The original proposal was, in fact, to be a percentage of your gross annual turnover. I calculated that in one instance, the fine would have been in the order of £75 million I think it was for Transco, maybe one of the train companies. That has gone. But even so, these fines and the publicity orders would do enormous damage to any organisation convicted of that offence. As I said to you, the Corporate Manslaughter Act is based on the Health and Safety at Work Act and health and safety laws generally. And we know that that is based on reasonable practicability. So what I would say to you is that there are some aspects you can look at. Your training. Training is essential. I think as we lead up towards the Olympics, and I was particularly conscious because of the nature of the work that you do, you're dealing with people whose first language may not be English, both as your staff and those who are coming to your hotels. I think it's also, your experience probably will be greater than mine on this, but when people are on holiday, they tend to let their guard down. They will do things they would not normally do. They are less concerned, strange enough, about their own safety. But it will be your job to ensure their safety. Don't underestimate the ability of people to be careless with their own lives. You need to train staff, and you need to set out in writing what that training is. I had an instance recently where the police went to an organisation, there had been a death, and they asked to have a look at the training manual. And it was a question of, here it is, handed over. Completely out of date, written once, never looked at again. The employees, when interviewed, said they had never seen it. It's no good writing it. It's got to be that people are trained, they're aware of it, and it's updated. And when I hear that an organisation relies on on-the-job training, the hairs in the back of my neck go up. Because I recognise a company who's complacent. And in my view, complacency kills. You need to avoid that. Going at the moment, where there is no evidence about the training records. And they say, oh, we always train people. Where's the evidence for it? There isn't any. You want to be in a position of showing what the training is for your staff. I can tell you with the Metropolitan Police, I've had a couple of cases involving members of their staff. They have training records. Everything the officer's done, the record is there. So I can show, I can see that the organisation takes training seriously. I have no concerns, therefore, about the organisation, the Metropolitan Police as an organisation, in how it trains its staff. You need to have the same mindset. Your instructions need to be clear. No ambiguities. If it be read two ways, you can be absolutely sure that somebody will read it the wrong way. Now, organisations develop. People join, people leave. Job titles, responsibilities change. Phone numbers alter. Are they updated? It's no good saying it's Fred who does something, because Fred may move on to something else, and there's a gap. I see it even in my own organisation. I can see notices on the wall. I find it quite amusing, really. I think that person left 2 years ago, and yet still their details are up there as being responsible for something. Fortunately, not on the health and safety side. You need to have a mechanism in place to demonstrate what you're doing, how you're training, how it's being re-evaluated. It may be expensive. It's less expensive than having a conviction against you. All right, let me just deal in conclusion. You can't depend on people taking responsibility for their own safety. It's your job to guard against them doing something irrational. Now, my objective here today isn't to avoid you being convicted of an offence, because if we get to that stage, it's probably too late. My concern is trying to avoid people being killed. There are over 200 a year minimum that die in work-related accidents. I suspect the figure is in fact far, far higher because of the way that these figures are calculated. Now, I'm happy to take questions in a moment, but what I would say, if you want to know more about the Corporate Manslaughter Act, how it affects you, your organisation, how you can perhaps avoid these situations, quite happy to come and speak to you. What I would ask is that you contact either David Noble or Nick Maddox through Gauntlet Insurance, and we can discuss things. That's all I want to say. I'm quite happy to take questions disruptive for your organisation. And when I am looking at a case, clearly I'm going to be looking at what was a risk assessment, but I also will want to know what training do people have, because I've had risk assessments, but the individual has not been trained, or there's no evidence that they've been trained. And I've got a case going at the moment on exactly that point. So I'm just, in a sense, using that to help you, because when you're looking at whether the organisation's conduct is far below what could be expected, one of the features will be how seriously do they take health and safety? How seriously do they deal with the question of training staff? And one of the things that's going to be relevant to me and to colleagues will be things like, do they train? How do we know they've trained? So from your point of view, it is a good basis. You can then see, have individuals been trained on the new procedures or not? And if they haven't, that in itself, I would hope, would be an indicator to you, you need to train. Clearly, risk assessment is the very first stage in that process. You need to then, in a sense, reinforce that as part of the training package.
Okay, David Morgan here has begged to ask a question, and you know he's not somebody to be argued with, as we know. So, David will have the final question on here.
If someone did die in one of our hotels, our establishments, what at the moment is the likelihood that one of us in this room will actually go to jail? And is that likelihood going to increase?
Under the Corporate Manslaughter Act, there's no personal liability. There is under the Health and Safety at Work Act, if you've condoned the breach. There's also the individual gross negligence. Now, that will always depend on what you as an individual did or didn't do and how that related to the individual who died. So it's impossible to argue that, but to discuss it. What I would say is this. At the moment, there was a case that came out, it was either last week or the week before last, talking about manslaughter. And the indication from that case is that you can expect to go to prison if convicted of manslaughter. That was in the context of what we call unlawful act manslaughter. But the read across is quite clear for gross negligence as well. And the reason is this. It's not just you made a mistake and so